playera de tajo. Ponte si quieres una tanga debajo. Haz con tu cuerpo lo que quieras, que carajos. Vamos mujer, baila hasta abajo. Menea con esa pollera de tajo. Ponte si quieres una tanga debajo. Haz con tu cuerpo lo que quieras, que carajos. Si se fue de casa ni una menos. Si se puso minifalda ni una menos. Si se pintó los labios ni una menos. Menos, ni una 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 menos, cabrón, ni una menos.
Am Montag ist der ganze Tag feministisch
und internationalistisch.
Radio Lora wird Radia.
Dein feministisches Radio auf 97,5 MHz.
Schalt dein feministisches Radio ein auf 97,5 MHz.
Schalt dein feministisches Radio ein auf 97,5 MHz.
Today from the Wings Archive, Two-Spirited Women Speak Out. The English term two-spirited is attributed to Cree elder Myra Laramie, who proposed it in 1990 at the third annual Intertribal Native American First Nations Gay and Lesbian Conference in Winnipeg. It's a translation from the Anishinaabe language that has gradually become a widely used term of respect.
After these women had the creative courageousness to speak out in front of their relatives and their elders in such a dignified way, it opened up the hearts of so many of us who possibly didn't understand this way of life before.
There's a river.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
During the week of September 14th through 17th, 1994, over 200 women gathered at the White Earth Ojibwe Nation in Callaway, Minnesota, as part of the Indigenous Women's Network Conference on Sustainable Communities. Under the themes, Ourselves, Our Families, Our Communities, Our Nations, women shared knowledge, resources, and strategies for strengthening their communities. Several of the speakers were two-spirited, gay, lesbian women, including Yako Myers, a Mohawk of the Iroquois Nation, a descendant of Tayano Indian, and an adopted Ojibwe grandmother. Myers is a licensed social worker, a published poet, and performer.
As I look out among my relatives and my elders, I get really emotional. I'm really honored to be here with you all this week. It has been a long journey for many of us who are two-spirit, a long journey for many of us who struggle every day of our lives to know who we are among our people. To know the culture and the traditions of our people who once remembered the two-spirit people. For many years, we have been behind the scenes, or for many years, we have been in bars drinking away our pain, suffering because we are not welcome in our homes, we're not welcome among our people. Or if we go among our people, we're expected to fit in, to become somebody that we are not. And that usually means by having a relationship and becoming married and having children. And then we live double lives. And then part of us dies, if not all of us. And we once again bury ourselves in our alcoholism or our drugs, or we commit suicide. That is the history of two-spirit people since we have had contact with the missionaries in the white world. Those ways have been lost for many of us. Over the last 5 years, 6 years, we have been gifted once again, because many of our elders who remember have come forward to help us, to love us and to nurture us, and to say that we do not go against the laws of nature. For within the laws of nature, there are species who come together of same sex. There are plants that carry the same sex. And so they teach us. They teach us about our self-identity, about our dignity once again in a loving and caring way. The struggle continues. As many of us, as many of my elders have speaked about the resistance, the struggling and the survival, we too, as two-spirit people, every day we wake up, we meet that resistance, we meet that struggle, we meet our survival day after day. At one time, about 4 years ago, in Minneapolis, there was something that was going on. And in Minneapolis, many two-spirit people work in positions that are in the social welfare, that work with children, who are the leaders in our communities in many ways, who are very quiet in their work. We don't need to be out there and boastful. What we do is we really look at who we are and our spirituality, and our spirituality has been our savior, our grace, and our ability to stand firm today, or my ability to be here among my elders and my relatives speaking today. That spirituality is my life. And 4 years ago, because of that, and because of our what we do in our communities with our agencies that we work, there was a hit list. And that hit list named all the two-spirit people in that community that were in positions of leadership. And what was said about that hit list is that any of us were caught out on a certain street, that we would be beaten up because they did not want us any longer. Because they said that we recruited little children. And that is not true, because it's a white man who recruits children. It is not us. And because of that, I called my aunt back in Oneida, Wisconsin, and I said to her, I said, Auntie, I said, this letter, this hit list is going on. What should I do? And she said to me, she says, you need to go meet where that source comes from. You need to meet it head on. And you need it to meet it in a good way. And I said to her, well, how do I do that? Because I'm scared. And I'm fearful for my life and fearful for the lives of my brothers and my sisters who do this work in a good way for the people. My auntie said, remember the great peacemaker. And she said, wherever the great peacemaker went, the great peacemaker spoke. That wherever he went, he said, I bring with me the purest of water so that we may drink and speak in a good way. I bring with me the softest of doe skins so we may wipe our eyes so that we can see in a good way. And she also said, a great peacemaker said that I bring with me the softest of an eagle plume so we may clean our ears in a good way so that we can hear one another in a good way. She gave me those words. And so I went to the person or people and we had a meeting. And much to my surprise, one of the people that were there were my sister, who 9 winters ago stood next to me as I received my name at the Longhouse Midwinter Ceremony. And I was really taken back by that because of all people, my sister. And I talked to her the way my auntie instructed me to talk to her. And from that experience, I learned one of the greatest things is that to be able to move with love and compassion and not to move with judgment or anger. And sometimes it's very difficult to do that when you feel that you're all alone in the world. And when you feel that you are the only spokesperson for our brothers and sisters, and you look around, where can I go for safety? Where can I go for comfort? Where can I go for the elders to help me to become who I am in a good way for the people? My grandmother always says to me, she says, Yahko, remember the survival of the people come first in yourself. And she said to me, she says, of all my granddaughters, I wish this path was not one of yours, for it's a path of loneliness and danger. And she gave me her blessings, and she still gives me her blessings every day. But it is a path of loneliness and danger. It is a path that has very little support at times. It's a path that I still see many of my brothers and sisters in bars drowning their fear or leaving home because they're banished from their home or they're ostracized from the home because who they are. What I ask in prayer every day of my life is to help us to remember the teachings that were once a part of this land, the teachings that were once part of our people. I'm not asking much. I don't think that I am. I don't think that my brothers and sisters are asking for much. I don't think that the elders who are supporting us are asking for much. But to remember those innate memories that we have all carried with us throughout our lifetime, and to help us to remember our culture and our teachings, and to help us to remember to move with the love and compassion that we as Indian people have the ability to do, but also the knowing that many of us are wounded, and that healing process of the woundedness sometimes takes a long time. And sometimes in that healing process, we don't necessarily mean to do harm to one another, but that harm happens. And then we carry that with us, and then we think there's something wrong with us. We think that the only way that we can be part of our people is to be married, or the way that we can only be part of our people, to be part of our ceremonies, is to be married. Some of us have the ability and the gift to do that, and other of us have a gift of what we have given by Creator to walk a different path. And that is strength also, and it is courage. An ability to walk for the survival of the people and then ourselves. Miigwech. Thank you.
That was Yako, a Mohawk of the Iroquois Nation. The next speaker is Bonnie Black Wolf. She's of the Blackfeet Nation, a musician, activist, and HIV positive.
I come to you today because I'm learning, as I get older, the importance of telling the truth. And I learned very young not to tell the truth because it was the difference between surviving and dying. And so to learn to tell the truth is a big deal. I'm 39 years old. I'm also on a healing journey from drugs and alcohol. I went into a center to get some help for that 8.5 years ago, and with much support have been able to stay sober. I'm also a lesbian woman, a two-spirited woman. I also have AIDS, and I want to tell you that I have AIDS not because of who I am, but because of what I chose to do. And excuse me, I'm having a lot of feelings about all this, but it is the behaviors and the choices that I made that put me in a position to get AIDS. And when I listen to everyone, and I'm so grateful to finally see in my lifetime, which has been, thank you, has been a very short lifetime, to see a vision realized for many people of us coming together. One of the things that greatly disturbs me is that if we don't have a body from chronic illness, from environmental and biological warfare, the combinations of all the things that are going on this planet, we will not be able to be here to come together. The history of healthcare and the history of disease of indigenous people in the world is one that it's very difficult to decide who our authority is And in a world where we've been separated from our communities and in a world where we've been separated from our families, it's hard to know. It's hard to know who to believe. If I believed what the Western non-Indigenous people in this country tell me, I would have been dead many years ago. When I was diagnosed with AIDS, I had a doctor tell me that I would live 2 years. I've had this virus in my body for somewhere between, we don't know, but somewhere between 10 and 14 years. I'm very fortunate in the sense that I was able to go into a recovery program from my alcoholism. The life expectancy for an Indigenous woman who one day becomes very sick and is told that she has AIDS is very short. In the urban areas, it can be as little as 18 days. We are caregivers, we are life givers. When we don't feel well, we continue to do our work because there are many things that are important to keep our lives and our communities going. And so sometimes we ignore our needs and we find out down the line that we're much sicker than we ever thought we were. And I just, you know, we don't have a lot of time today, but I really want to encourage us to go home. I really want to encourage us to go to our elders and to talk about how can we deal with this? What can we do? What can I learn from you about learning to live in a good way with the rest of the life that I have? I believe that this disease in some ways is a mirror of what's going on in the Mother Earth. All the pollutions, all the combinations of things that have been unleashed in our environment, that have been created by those that would manipulate sacred things. This is a sum total of what that looks like, and it's living in my body. My life force is affected by all of those things in my blood. The other part of it is that one of the things that the media and the healthcare system, the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, the World Health Organization, and even through Indian Health, is that they try to scare us to death and make us believe that we are going to ultimately die. I believe if we go home, that potential is there. If we don't go home, that potential is there. And I don't think it has to be that way. I have a label, you know, acquired immune deficiency syndrome. I've been trying to think of a good, you know, what do they call that? Another way to describe it for that word. But there have been times, tuberculosis, diabetes, cancer, all these labels that put us in a paralyzed position where we allow this predator to come in and take away our life force. And to believe one more time that we are nothing and we are no one and we deserve to die. These are the messages that I fight on a daily basis. And I don't know what to say. There are so many things I could say to you. But everyone that has spoken here, that has said something in conversations and workshops, has said the things that teach us a better way to live. And if there are any gifts in this disease for me, one of those is that I'm getting an opportunity to become who I am. And it's unfortunate that I had to go to that length to find out how to do that. They tell us through Indian Health, there they have those little pie diagrams, and we end up in the other category, which is listed as 1%. And I want to say 1% of what, first of all? And I also want to say, because of the genocide of Indigenous people in the world, 1% is a lot. The other part of that is that the increase in AIDS infection in people of color, including Indigenous people in this country, is the highest growing rate of infection that there is. They don't tell you that it falls under the 1%. You know, in 1993, there was a 33% increase in infection. I don't tell you that to scare you, but I want to tell you the truth. AIDS does not, you know, there's a lot of stereotypes about what it looks like. You know, my stereotype was a white gay man who looked emaciated, had wasting syndrome, and you could see it and you would know it. And that's not the case. Women's systems symptoms manifest very differently. In Indian women, symptoms manifest very differently. They put no time or study into looking at how AIDS affects us physically, emotionally, and spiritually. The other thing is that this disease makes an attempt to mine our minds. That's something that is said a lot. Not only does it work on destroying our physical bodies and our central nervous systems, but our mind and our spirit as well. And I have watched many people pass, but I also know that at some point we have been asked by our Creator to carry a message to you, and that we are mirrors of what's going on around us. And I hope that I can come to you sometime and say, I am grateful to have this job. There are so many losses involved with this, you know, and I guess some of us are kind of used to a lot of losses, especially when it comes to disease. But I ask you to open your hearts and your minds, because there will be many of us coming home, and some of us will be coming home to pass on, and we're going to need your help. And some of us will be gay. Some of us are gay. And I also want to make the distinction between AIDS and being gay or being two-spirited. This disease knows no gender. It knows no color. And we are at risk. But if we have a cultural base, if we can recognize our cultural traumas, if we can recognize and own who we are and love one another, we have a real good chance of making healthy choices to not become infected. The thing that scares me the most is that I believe this disease, at its worst, has the potential to wipe out the rest of the indigenous people in this country, because we are so off balance and we are so afraid. But I believe we want to live and we want to come together, and that power will overcome that predator. But I need your help, and my brothers and sisters out there need your help. So if your gay relative comes home, or your relative comes home and says, I have AIDS, I ask you to think and pray about whether or not you're going to turn your back on them out of moral judgments that come from another place and another time that have nothing to do with us. And that's that Western thinking one more time that separates us from spirit. I wish we had more time for dialogue, but there's so much that was given to me at this conference. Lateral oppression, that concept of how we hurt one another and the pain that it creates, that is alive and well in the AIDS community. If we can't stop doing it to each other, I don't know what's going to happen. And I remember Cecilia talking about, you know, becoming an older woman and looking forward to that, and what a powerful thing that is. And I look at the little children here, and I want to see them have that. I want to see them complete that circle. So please don't ignore it, and please don't think that you're immune, and please don't let them scare you to death, because if there's one thing that I do know, it's that our Creator is much bigger than AIDS will ever be. And I thank you for being here today.
That was Bonnie Blackwolf of the Blackfeet Nation speaking at the Indigenous Women's Network Conference at the White Earth Reservation. This piece was produced in the studios of Radio KMUD, Garberville, California. For Wings, this is Agnes Patak.
One of the organizers of the conference spoke with Lisa Hayes.
Marcia Gomez is a co-founder of the Indigenous Women's Network.
The two-spirited women, Yako, the Mohawk, and Bonnie, Lakota, who's living with AIDS, came forth remembering our power, and they had a lot of support and understanding. I believe there's been a lot of healing of the internalized depression within our own communities that make it a little easier for two-spirited people to come out. There have been two-spirited gatherings that deal with our issues as indigenous gay people, but at national and international gatherings, it has not been a focus. When you're faced with so many multifaceted issues of land rights and violations against the land and exploitation of mineral resources and your basic rights to live as human beings, then it just becomes on the back burner, so to speak. I believe that two-spirited people, many of them being the leaders and trailblazers within their communities, work on those issues on a consistent basis for many, many years and have gained the respect and love within their communities that are now coming forth and saying, this is the way I have been all along, or being embraced, or at least there is an understanding that is trying to come to surface now among groups at large where there had not been much discussion. You're going to have homophobia within any culture, but we really need to understand that in traditional Native American societies, and I'm talking about traditional before the colonization, I'm talking before 500 years, I'm talking when most of our societies were matrilineal and matriarchal, that gays and lesbians were called people with two spirits. They were respected in their community because the people believed they possessed both the masculine and the feminine spirit, which gave them the strength and the insight of internal unity. Many of the two-spirited people were given special roles within their nation. Within their culture, they were medicine people, shamans. They had special rights and privileges and work that they did with the children, with the cooking. I believe that the strength of these two women set forth a futuristic agenda for two-spirited women as well. We don't want to separate ourselves. I don't think that that's what Yako and Bonnie were talking about at all. They're talking about making this an integral part of all of our lives. What these women did in the courage that they showed allowed other women who had been living with the same fears, the same isolation, and the same pain to come forward. After their talks, after their keynotes, there were two-spirited talking circles where women were able to come together and give one another the support that they so needed at that time, organize, strategize, and even plan a two-spirited conference for 1995. Given the fact that I've seen so much development, appropriate development in the last 10 years, gives me much hope for the future. Indigenous women are on the front lines of a lot of the issues that the world faces at large. They're on the front line of the ecological crisis. They're on the front line of survival of their nations, of their languages, of their religions, of the minerals that are underneath the earth, that are in the earth, that we want to stay there so it does not poison the rest of the world. People need to understand that the gestation of a bomb really begins on native land where they extract the uranium. So when you understand that context and that cycle, you really understand how indigenous women, being the backbone of their nation, the givers of life, the sustainers of life, have an incredible responsibility, a sweet responsibility to the sacred earth and to all peoples, not just Indian Nation, but to the world at large. I see a vision of self-sovereignty where indigenous peoples can govern themselves in their own lands and develop their own resources. We're really tired of having other people tell us how to live our lives and what we should do with our lands and our bodies. It is time for us to set forth our own agenda and make those decisions for ourselves, for our communities, for our nations, and for the world at large.
Marcia Gomez was one of the organizers of the 1994 Indigenous Women's Network Conference. She is also a well-known sculptor whose work